It's Sunday, the 15th of November 2015, the 3rd of Kislev 5776, and on 558 AM, digital radio, online, and as a podcast. This is Sunday Jewish Radio on Spectrum Radio. I'm Phil Dave. Coming up, the man who bills himself as the UK's only Haredi stand-up comedian will be speaking to Kate Fulton. Ashley Blaker will tell us about his current synagogue tour, as well as his chosen career path. Now, you may be aware that today sees the annual Ajax parade, which will take place at the Cenotaph from about 2 p.m. this afternoon. So our main story on Sunday Jewish Radio this week is based on that. We shall be speaking to Brian Bloom, who's the national chairman for Ajax, and he'll be telling me what we can expect from today's event, as well as the organisation itself. And on Roundtable this week, as we'll hear in the news with Viv in just a moment, that there's still a lot of news about Israel making the headlines. Clive and Adam will discuss with their guests retired audiobook reader Denise Asserson and Ahuva Cohen from the New End Theatre Beyond about not only Boris Johnson's visit this week, but the news that the EU has approved guidelines for member states to label products made in West Bank settlements. So there is a lot to be discussed. But before all of that, with both those stories and a roundup of the other Jewish news stories from the past week, here's Vivian Krieger.
Boris Johnson had to cancel two of his planned meetings in the West Bank on his three-day trade trip to Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories because of security fears. The MP and Mayor of London had spoken out about his opposition to those who wanted a boycott of Israeli goods. He'd said that those who endorsed it were foolish and a very small minority. He also questioned the logic of shunning the Middle East's one functioning democracy and made it clear he wants to build London's trading links with Israel, particularly with technology businesses. A meeting with the Palestinian Prime Minister did go ahead, but the media didn't accompany Mr. Johnson. The website of JFS, Britain's largest Jewish school, had to be taken offline after it was hacked by extremists. The hackers posted a message that read, "Islam is the true religion." JFS, which has around 2,000 Jewish students, responded quickly and their web support team removed the message. The website is now back online. The Community Security Trust, which was contacted by JFS about the incident, said they're working closely with the school. An Israeli guard on Jerusalem's light rail has been stabbed in an attack by two young Arab boys. The guard, believed to be in his 20s, managed to fire a gun at one boy who was wounded. The second boy was subdued by passengers on the light rail until police arrived and took him into custody. The guard's condition in hospital is stable, and the 11-year-old boy he shot is unconscious and on a ventilator. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told Barack Obama that he's still committed to a Palestinian state, providing that it's demilitarized and recognizes the right of Israel to exist. Mr. Netanyahu made his comments to the US President at the White House in their first meeting for 12 months. Mr. Obama wanted to seek ways to avoid further violence between Israel and the Palestinians and to discuss Iran and Syria. Also high on the agenda was the renegotiation of a 10-year, multi-billion dollar package of military aid for Israel. The European Union has approved guidelines for member states to label products that are made in West Bank settlements. The move has drawn angry condemnation from Israel and accusations of anti-Semitism. The EU has argued that it's a technical move and will barely affect trade, and claims that it is independent of any political considerations. Israel's foreign ministry has warned it could affect ties with Brussels and says it's applying a double standard to Israel while ignoring 200 other territorial disputes around the world. And finally, a British couple have given the Jewish community of Lodz in Poland its first new Torah scroll since World War II, after celebrating their son's bar mitzvah there. Philanthropists Hilton and Louise Nathanson, whose families come from the region, made the donation after their son Tate's ceremony. The Torah scroll took 6 months to write, with the last few letters being left for the Nathansons to fill in during the ceremony, which took place last month. And that's the news this week.
Thank you, Viv. Well, it's that time now when Dana Turman joins me, Clive Roslin, in the studio to review this week's Jewish newspapers. Diana, first the front pages, as usual.
As usual, Clive. I think we'll start with the Jewish News. And a photograph of the, this is going to go right across both papers, this news about Boris going to the West Bank.
And oh, yes, that certainly does.
Their title, the Jewish News' title, is The Bank That Likes to Say No, meaning, of course,
meaning
the
West Bank.
In hindsight, the Jewish News says, it wouldn't have required much for Boris Johnson to be shunned by the Palestinians on his tour of Israel and the West Bank. That the mayor even set foot in Israel would frankly have been too much for many in Ramallah. The fact that he then had the audacity to praise Israel's high-tech achievements and condemn boycotts would have crossed a red line for many more. Now, some of this has been in our news with Viv, and a lot of it, I think, is in the JC as well.
It certainly is. The JC's full of it. But one thing I will mention is in the JC, because they haven't got that on the front page, but they have got a picture on the front page of Boris, as they say, when Boris cried. And it's a picture of London Mayor Boris Johnson visibly overcome during a visit to Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem this week. But the front page is all about men who refuse a get may lose burial rights. And it's an exclusive by Simon Rocker. And he says men who refuse to give their wives a religious bill of divorce may be stripped of their burial rights, the London Beth Din has confirmed. And the religious court of Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis last week took the unprecedented step of publishing a notice in the JC banning from synagogue a man who had denied his wife a get. Do you think that's a good thing?
I do think it's a good thing. I wonder if they'll have enough votes to get it through.
Well, if the Beth Din has actually said yes,
I presume
they probably will.
Is that a done deal then, do you think, yes, once the Beth Din has said yes?
Yes. That's the opinion that the paper seems to give anyway.
I wonder if there's any cause for appeal by some of the men who may argue that, you know, that the two things are not related. In other words, giving a get and having burial rights.
We shall have to wait and see.
We shall have to wait and see indeed.
One thing to be said about it,
yeah,
is that in the article, I'll just quickly quote it, it says nearly 20 years ago, the United Synagogue approved sanctions against get refusers, denying them synagogue honours such as being called to the Torah. I never knew that.
Oh, that is interesting.
That is interesting. So maybe it'll all go through.
Right. Now, we've got a story in the Jewish News, which is about Roman Catholic leaders who've told their schools to teach Judaism alongside Christianity in GCSE religious studies. The church's edict follows reforms made to the exam last year, which require schools to teach two religions. But then it's followed by a rather extraordinary part of the article, and I'm quoting here, which says, the Catholic Education Service said it chose Judaism so our pupils can gain a thorough understanding of the richness and breadth of 2,000 years of Catholic theology and culture. What do you make of that?
Well, having gone to a Catholic school, I understand that completely. The Catholics believe that their religion is the only true religion, but they also believe that it comes from the Jewish religion, which is now an antique religion.
Ah, I see.
It's not meant unpleasantly at all.
Well, good, because it's somewhat confusing when you read it, actually. It's a somewhat ambivalent way of putting it.
But that's what it means.
Yes.
And, of course, the Pope, that's also partly to do with it. The Pope is extremely pro-Jewish.
Yes, that's true. But a former Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain, here in the article, said the Roman Catholic Church decision made no sense, given that Islam is the country's second biggest religion by quite some distance.
Well, that's probably true as well.
This is not a good decision, he said.
Well, he would.
Well, he would, wouldn't he? Yes, absolutely. But that is a point. It is a point.
It is. Anyway, there's a very interesting article in the JC, which is, in a sense, a rather sad story, but it also has a happy ending, if you like. The headline is Heroism Under the Hammer, and a family has found its grandfather's stolen World War I medals in an auction catalogue 20 years later, and there's a picture of all the medals that he had. There are five of them. And the family are terribly delighted about it and hope eventually get hold again of them. Stephen Davis, who's part of the family, says it's an important family heirloom. None of us knew our grandfather. It may sound trivial, but we would like to connect with a man who we've heard all stories about, a great man about whom my father and his brothers all used to speak very highly of him. He was a man of action and a man of integrity, as demonstrated by the fact that he won a military cross.
Oh, indeed. I think their problem may be that they've now got to persuade the purchaser who bought them in the first place
to hand them over.
To hand them over. And will he expect some reward?
Well, no doubt he...
Monetary reward. Yes. After all, he's now at a loss for them.
Exactly. He paid quite a lot of money for them.
However good their cause is.
Yes.
Right. Now, we've got a major survey on British Jews' thoughts about Israel. And this has shown that there are feelings of despair amongst 68% of the poll that commissioning group Yachad went in for, with three quarters felt that settlements were a major obstacle to peace. And the author said it also showed that younger Jews would support tougher action against Israel if they felt it would help the stalled peace process.
I think there's a lot in that.
There is a lot in that, yes. There is indeed. But whether it'll ever come to that is another matter.
Yeah, indeed. There's a fascinating article in the Jewish Chronicle which is headed Joint Project Bolsters Ties Between Minorities. And it goes on to say, the visit of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi to Britain provides the opportunity to assess the links between his country's diaspora and the Jewish community. And the announcement in June that he would visit Israel later this year revealed the depth of India's diplomatic, business and cultural ties with Jerusalem, and his arrival in London this week shines a light on the ever-strengthening relationship between British Hindus and Jews. And for three decades, communal leaders have worked together to make the most of shared experiences as a minority. It's fascinating, isn't it?
Good for them.
It's lovely because I know quite a few Indians, and they are terribly pro-Jewish and interested in Jewish things, just as I find Hindu things very interesting as well.
Yes. Yes, it's a different angle to the whole thing, isn't it? It's very nice, yes. Well, now we've got an extraordinary story near the end of our press review. This is in the Jewish News, page 8. It's about two children who haven't spoken to each other for 6 months, who are the son and daughter of a woman who died a month ago. And this woman married an observant Czech Jew, but she herself did not convert. And she ceased observing Jewish rules, according to this article, when her husband died in 1974. Now, she's just died. And the judge says the legal fireworks which have ensued as to where she's going to be buried would need the judgment of Solomon, he says, to sort it out before the two parties could reach an agreement, which they finally did, because the daughter wanted her mother buried in a non-Jewish cemetery in East Sheen, and the son wanted her buried in Kensal Green, and they couldn't agree on it. So finally, they've agreed to hold the service in two halves. The first part will be solemnly traditional, after which the son can leave, and the second half will include popular songs.
Yes, because he wanted a Jewish funeral, complete Jewish funeral. There's been in a number of newspapers, that story, and I find it, you're right, it's an extraordinary story.
Absolutely extraordinary. It's rather sad, actually.
We end today with an advertisement in the Jewish News, and it's lovely. It appeals to my punning. I love making bad puns. And this is full of very good puns. It's an advertisement for Hanukkah in the Square, WC2, City of Westminster, with a 6 p.m. candle lighting with Mayor of London Boris Johnson, there he is again, and entertainment by the Maccabees. Or maybe I should say the Maccabeats. So there you are. It's on Thursday the 10th of December in Trafalgar Square. And there'll be live music, and here's another pun, Dreidelman and Donuts. And there we are, Dinah. Thank you. More from you same time next week.
Pleasure, Clive.
And our main story on Sunday Jewish Radio this week is that today sees the annual Ajax Parade taking place later on at the Cenotaph. Phil has been speaking to Brian Bloom, the nation chairman for the organisation, to talk about the event as well as Ajax. Phil started by asking Brian Bloom to tell us about the history of the charity.
Ajax was founded after the end of the First World War in 1921. It was actually founded by 90 members only of the ex-service personnel, Jewish ex-service personnel who had served in the war. And at that time, we were experiencing in this country, unfortunately, a lot of anti-Semitism. And there was also a need for help for the veterans, for welfare, and for support, and for recognition. And it was decided in 1921 that the Cenotaph would be created by Lutyens in Whitehall, and the League of Jewish Ex-Servicemen and Women and the League for the Non-Jewish were served at the same time. So we morphed into the Association of Jewish Ex-Servicemen and Women, and the Royal British Legion was founded at the same time. So the two organisations, although separate, share the same beliefs in that we are British and we are proud of our service and we want to commemorate and remember those the sacrifice of the First World War in those days and to support the welfare of those ex-service men and women. In our case, with the addition of the fight against anti-Semitism.
The actual organisation itself obviously has been around for a great number of years, so I'm guessing that there aren't any of the founding members still involved, but are there any maybe members of families, perhaps, who originally started the organisation? Has it kept on through passing it on to generation, or is it pretty much a different band altogether now?
Well, it does go from generation to generation, and obviously we no longer have the First World War veterans. And we are now experiencing that the Second World War veterans have now been members of Ajax for, well, coming up to, 70 years. And we are still in contact with many of them, and many of them had fathers who actually served in the First World War. And take my case just for example. We had family members serving in the First World War. My father and his brothers served in the Second World War. And in my case, I served in the Royal Naval Reserve from 1975 to 1994. So it's a continuation. And very often we have the families and now the grandchildren, my grandchildren included. It will carry on.
And so what's your role in Ajax? What do you do?
I'm the national chairman, which is a great pride and privilege to be the national chairman of an organisation which covers, I was going to say a spectrum, but excuse the pun, of
we'll allow that.
A spectrum of needs. We still, to this day, we have remembrance as the one of the prime meanings of what we're about, but we have welfare. We have a huge welfare division which we support the ex-service personnel. And we have an education policy to go alongside that. For example, on Wednesday, we had the great pleasure and privilege to be invited to Emmanuel College in Bushy, where we were invited to their assembly and their remembrance service. And we went along there and we took our standards, a couple of our standards, and some of our veterans, and we spoke to the school. And this is part of our education procedure to actually continue the remembrance of what we as British Jewish men and women have contributed to this country and the service that we have done.
And there seems to be quite a misnomer, for want of a better term, that would suggest that younger generations don't really have an understanding or an interest in maybe what military personnel have been through in past decades. What reaction would you say you get when you do talk to schools? How do they respond normally to what you have to say?
It can be very, very positive, but we also, I agree, we do have some negative reaction. It depends on the families. Some families will pass on that we will ask the children, did your father or mother serve, or your grandparents? And the ones, many of them know. I would say at least 50% of them know what their grandparents, what their family have, how they served. Others do not. That's part of the education procedure.
Well, hopefully with any luck, that your continuing work will obviously help combat that now. Let's talk about the main event that is happening today, of course. That's Sunday
Indeed.
The 15th. That's the Ajax Parade. What can we expect from this year?
Well, this is our 81st Ajax Parade.
Wow.
And yes, wow. We missed a few years during the Second World War because we obviously couldn't parade. But it's the 81st one. Now, we're privileged this year to have Field Marshal Lord Guthrie as our reviewing officer. He will review the parade. We will parade three battalions this year. It'll be around about 1,000 members parading. And that will be at the cenotaph at Whitehall. And we will have a military band there, and we will have the dignitaries from the Jewish communities and the mayors and mayoresses of London and the politicians. It's a great thing for the Jewish people to be recognised. It's something that always amazes me, that the response we get from the general public and from the politicians, and the Prime Minister's been fantastic, for example. They're so positive for us as the Jewish people, and they support us and they honour us. Last week we were at the Field of Remembrance at Westminster Abbey, and among many other plots, and the Ajax plot, we had 150 Mogen David markers commemorating the dead, the ones who were killed in action.
They're the ones that look a little bit like the ones we see, the crosses with poppies,
correct.
But they're the ones Mogen David instead.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the Duke of Edinburgh kindly stopped and chatted to us. And he was very positive with us. And after he left, Prince Harry actually stopped as well and chatted to us. So the parades and the Field of Remembrance at Westminster Abbey, they don't only give us, the Jewish people, a pride in ourselves and what we've contributed to this country, but it's also a recognition by the country of what we are and what we have contributed and what we have done.
Which I know, obviously, is not necessarily the motivation behind it, but I dare
not
say it's very,
not
very nice to
not
get that
all.
Recognition.
Absolutely, because it's not about you and I, it's about them, it's about what the contribution they have made. They gave their lives, many of them, for what they believed in. And what they believed in was basically a Jewish ethic and a British ethic of a moral code, which is laudable. And we're so proud of them. And we're so proud to actually say to people, we today are marching with veterans of the Second World War, and we still, even today, have Jewish men and women serving in Her Majesty's Armed Forces today, whether it be in the Army, the Air Force, or the Navy. We still have serving Jewish personnel.
So if someone wants to share in that recognition and celebration of all Jewish servicemen and women who are either past armed forces or current armed forces, is it too late for them to come down and observe the parade today, which starts at 1:45, I believe?
Well, no, it starts, the assembly is around 1:45, but the parade actually starts at 2 o'clock.
All right.
It gets quite crowded, but yes, please, come and join us. It's an experience you will remember for the rest of your lives and hopefully pass on to your children. It's a marvellous thing to see the response from the old chaps, some of them in wheelchairs, and the younger chaps and lasses as well. You know, let's make it clear. We have had serving personnel in the National Servicemen served up until 1960. And we have all the subsequent wars from after the Second World War. We've got Suez, we've got Cyprus and Iraq, the troubles in Northern Ireland, etc., etc. It's a continuous remembrance of those that have gone before us.
Brian Bloom talking to me there about Ajax, as well as the annual parade taking place today at the Cenotaph. If you would like more information about them or today's event, then you can go to our Facebook page. The details are coming up. I myself should be hot-footing down there this afternoon as well, so maybe we'll see you down there. Don't forget, if you would like to comment on any of the stories that you hear on Sunday Jewish Radio, you are very welcome to do so. You can email us on studio@sundayjewishradio.co.uk, and we can also be contacted via social media. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/Sunday Jewish Radio, and on Twitter, we are @SundayJRadio. Now, when you hear the term Jewish comedian, who do you think of? Jackie Mason? Joan Rivers? Maybe even David Baddiel. Well, our next guest can be added to the list of Jewish comedians, but he's probably one of the only ones you'll find on the list of Haredi Jewish comedians. Ashley Blaker is currently on tour with his show, Ungefiltered. Get it? Kate Fulton has been speaking to him to find out more, and she started by asking him how he got into stand-up in the first place.
I went to Haberdashers, proper Jewish school.
Yeah.
It's a real Jewish school. And I think I must have absolutely baffled my teachers, because when I was 16, you had to do like a careers meeting. I think that had, you know, deciding what A-levels you're going to do, and you go in and you go, what do you want to do? And they say, I want to be a barrister. And then
most of them go.
And then they go, okay, right, so you want to read history and English and blah, blah, blah. And I went in there, I said, I want to be a stand-up comedian. And they knew what to say.
Gosh, is that where you met Matt Lucas? Wasn't he also there?
He was also at school.
Were you friends?
We were very good friends, yeah.
Even then?
Yes, yeah, when I was about 13. We met one day. I went out, he was in the year above me, and I was in the first year. And for some reason, I'd been off school, ill or something, as was often my way. And he was as well, both sickly boys, we had that in common. And I had been watching some TV programme. And someone called Matt from Stanmore rang in and was saying something about, it was some kind of TV review thing. And I went up to him the next day and said, did you ring up a programme in the day yesterday? Were you on telly? And we bonded over that.
That's beautiful. We bonded
over a love of TV and a love of being off school ill.
Everybody wants to know, because of course you're really well known for producing and writing stuff for him. Mm. Where did that come from then? How did that happen? Because you're both doing your A-levels. I mean, it's quite an academic, straight-laced sausage machine of a school.
Yes, exactly. It's quite strange. I mean, we both really loved comedy, liked performing, liked making people laugh. Matt was a very good actor. I wasn't. We were in a school play together, actually, and he was the lead in She Stoops to Conquer, and I had one line. I think I had four words. Nah, mine for certain. So, and I delivered it adequately, I would say.
Right.
But we had a good laugh on it. When I was about 16, Matt rang me up one day, and he'd just done this course about how to become a stand-up comedian. And he had discovered, I didn't know this, that if you looked in Time Out and saw the club listings and rang them up, the phone numbers, they would give you an open spot. He'd let you do 5 minutes. I don't think they actually do that anymore. I think now it's a lot more competitive, and they won't even let you on stage until you have hours of YouTube videos and stuff. But back then, you just rang up and just could have been anyone. Because, yeah, my name's Ashley. Can I come and perform one night? And they'd say, yeah, okay, 5 minutes. And if you're good, anyway, so he said, I'm doing this. Do you fancy doing it as well? We could do it together, you know, as a kind of, not do it on stage together, but we could do this as an experience together and shout. Yeah, all right, you know, I'm kind of game. So I was 16.
Gosh, did you write the material at that point?
So I wrote my material and was performing, 16 years old. And I was 16, I was on bills with Harry Hill and Lee Evans and Eddie Izzard and people like that. And quite weird. Anyway, so it took a long journey. So long journey, though, anyway, to get back to actually performing. I kind of stopped. I kind of got out of it a little bit. And then somehow, over the last few years, the bug came back.
And did you decide you were going to have some kind of proper career? Not at all.
I did go to... So I read history at Oxford, and then I was doing a PhD at Cambridge, And so I did kind of think I'd probably end up in academia or something, but kind of got a bit bored of it, left and thought, well, what am I going to do with my life? Had no idea what to do. Not a lot of people actually want to employ you when your sole expertise is 17th century English church history. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly few opportunities.
Very strange people out there, aren't they?
Yeah, it's very, very, very few opportunities. So I was having a drink. This is totally true. I was having a drink with a former teacher from school one night in St. Albans. It was a Thursday night. And I said to him, I don't know what I'm going to do. There's no jobs out there. No one wants to employ me. He said, have you ever looked in the Media Guardian? And I said, I don't know. What is that? What's that? You know? And he said, oh, it's the Guardian newspaper on a Monday. They have this supplement called the Media Guardian, and if you look in it, maybe there's something that could be of interest. Well, so anyway, that was Thursday night. 4 days later, I bought the Media Guardian for the first time, and there was an advert in it saying, do you have funny bones? The BBC needs trainee comedy producers. And I applied. 10 weeks later, started.
That's a
and 10 weeks
story.
And 10 weeks, in those 10 weeks, I bought the Media Guardian every week. And I never even applied for a single other job because there was never another job that was kind of relevant. Yeah. So there it was. That's
Bichette,
exactly. I was going to say that's kind of, if you want to be really frum, that's what we call Hashgacha Pratis. That's kind of, you know, God running the world. A very strange thing. I had never heard of it. And then the week before, and I'd kind of, Matt and I, we'd kind of drifted apart a little bit because he was doing stuff on Shooting Stars at that time. I'd been at university, whatever. But in my very first, no, not my first week, the week before I started work at the BBC, I was walking in Soho and bumped into Matt. And he said, oh, what are you doing? Whatever. We sat down, we went and had a sit down for a bit. And I said, oh, I've got this new job. I don't know what we're going to do. We've kind of done a few things, hasn't quite taken off, me and David. And I said, well, you know, I've got this radio gig. We should do something. We should do a show. We should do a sketch show. And about two or three months later, we're making Little Britain. So there you
really?
Go. So
and then
these
just
little opportunities, these little opportunities come, and yeah,
you should
you
go back
know.
To school and tell them. It's not just about being a barrister; it's about following what
it's about being lucky.
Well, there is that as well. There is,
and it's about it is about following you. But that's the thing; I feel slightly embarrassed because I kind of didn't. I didn't have a dream. People say, "Well, you must have had a real dream to work in comedy." Well, not at that point. I didn't. I mean, it just landed. Somebody said, buy
right.
the paper.
Yeah.
I bought a paper, there it was. I somehow got a job. I'm not entirely sure how, to be honest.
Have you got brothers and sisters?
I have one brother who's a QC.
Oh, so, I take it all back. Barristers are fabulous. And
yeah.
I was one myself once. So. You're still religious. I mean, you look as if you are.
Probably the only, not probably, I'm definitely the only couple sitsis and payers in the comedy business. I think I'm almost certainly also the only person who works in TV in this country who doesn't actually own a TV. So I have no idea.
I don't own a TV.
So I have no idea. So people, I go to work and people say, oh, did you see the show? And I have to kind of bluff and go, yeah.
Do you ever see bits on your phone?
Not my phone, no. Sometimes you like to see if I really want to see something. But I you know what? Ignorance is bliss. I'm quite happy not to see something.
So you'll have written the show
seen,
and you've never seen it?
No,
that's
exactly.
Incredible.
I've never seen lots. I've never seen, like, someone was talking about, like,
Use at 10?
Strictly Come Dancing. I've never seen it. I've never seen The X Factor. Never seen any of those things. And yeah, it's kind of weird.
A helpline if you need to.
Well, I write topical comedy sometimes as well, so it's kind of weird. I wrote a very, very. I'm not so bad. I can do. Last week I wrote a very good joke about Arthur Scargill.
Do you feel sometimes being the only religious Jew in the village? Do you feel a sense of how do I keep my good character traits?
No, I don't find it a problem, but I do kind of talk about that in my show, in my stand-up show. So that's kind of, you know, I talk about a lot of the issues and there's a lot of comedy in it and, you know, some of my own kind of craziness and how that comes into play. No, I don't find it a real problem. I mean, genuinely, in a kind of, to give a kind of serious, non-funny answer, there's people swearing the whole time and there's people talking about horrible things. No, I mean, just generally, just everyday conversation. What I find really interesting is that when you set a good example and when you actually, you know, try and make like a kiddish Hashem in the workplace and try and impress people in that way, people really do notice. It's incredible. I mean, whenever, I've noticed this a lot, when anyone ever swears in front of me, they immediately apologise. So when you consider most people kind of, you know, swear in every sentence,
and
without even thinking about it, the fact that they notice and won't do it in front of me, it's saying something.
It's respectful.
Shows you what but it shows you what an opportunity you have to, if you behave well, to create a good name.
Tell us about your tour.
So my tour is called Ungefiltered. So I'd say
Ungefiltered.
Ungefiltered.
Come on, fish, for those who may not know.
Yeah, if you don't know what gefilte fish is,
maybe you should be listening.
You're listening to the wrong podcast. You shouldn't be allowed to download the Jewish podcast if you don't know what gefilte fish is.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
So a stand-up comedy tour. I really wanted to do a full-length comedy show. So it's kind of an 80-minute thing. I wanted to reach as wide a audience as possible. Could have done it in theatres, and we actually are doing a few dates at the end that are in those kind of venues. But I wanted to reach the widest Jewish possible audience.
In all areas of North London or all areas of...
All over the country. So the thing is, we're trying to do it in shuls, in synagogues, because that's where Jews are and can actually reach people. And actually, I see myself, you know how like Lubavitch are like, they have like shluchim, they have emissaries who go around the country to all kinds of weird places. I'm kind of a comedy shliach, so I'm going to all these kind of quite strange places, some would think. So it's not just going to Edgware, Stanmore and Golders Green, but we're doing the show in Brighton, in Hull, Sheffield, St Anne's, places with quite smaller Jewish communities, but who I think, you know, they don't have stuff coming to them normally.
So if quite we want nice to find to it, if our listeners want to find out how to cut your shows, how to get tickets,
so
times,
I've got a website, ashleyblaker.com.
Ashleyblaker.com.
ashleyblaker.com, and there's all the information. You can buy tickets, all the dates, and yeah, almost certainly coming to a venue near you.
The brilliantly funny Ashley Blaker speaking to Kate Fulton there. And if you'd like more information about his current show, Ungefiltered, then you can either go to the website he's just mentioned, ashleyblaker.com, or you can go to our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Sunday Jewish Radio.
You're listening to Sunday Jewish Radio on Spectrum Radio. It's now time for this week's roundtable. I'm Clive Roslin, and joining Adam Bradley and me this week are retired audiobook reader Denise Asserson and Ahuva Cohen from the New End Theatre Beyond, two of my favourite women. The subject today is broken into two parts, the first being that London Mayor Boris Johnson, as we've been hearing in the programme, has been visiting the Jewish state, and although it hasn't been as straightforward as he might have liked, he's made it very clear what he thinks of Israel. Also this week, so has the EU. The second part of our discussion shall be how the EU has approved guidelines for member states to label products made in West Bank settlements. So a lot to be discussed. So let's get straight on with it. Ahuva, are you pleased with Boris' attitude towards Israel?
Well, look, Boris is eyeing his next election, and he is after Jewish votes and keeping a good relationship with Israel. He has an agenda, and he expressed it as a diplomat should.
And it's as simple as that, in your view?
It's as simple as that.
In fairness, all politicians have an agenda. I think Boris's agenda seems to be, in my opinion, quite accurate.
I think, in fact, he hasn't done himself any good as far as the general public in this country is concerned over what has happened there, to be honest. Denise, what do you think?
Well, I've just finished reading his book on Churchill, which is absolutely wonderful, and you can feel in that book that he's very pro-Jewish. It doesn't come out a lot, but he's certainly pro-Churchill. I think he wants to become Prime Minister as Churchill. But there's been a lot of discussion about him.
Well, the newspapers...
Good and bad.
Yeah, indeed, because the newspapers in this country have been saying that he's not done himself any good by what he's said in Israel. And it will annoy all those, not particularly, from their point of view, anti-Jewish, but anti-Israel, because they believe that Israel, I'm just saying what they believe, Israel is an aggressor.
Well, it depends which newspapers you look at, really. Again, what Hoover was saying about politicians having agendas, so do newspapers. I mean, you look at The Telegraph, historically a Conservative newspaper, they're quite supportive of what he said, and they reported it in a very positive manner.
They did the Times as well.
Yeah, the Times as well. You look at the Mirror, Boris's gaffe in
Israel.
All
Guardian.
All the Guardian. Exactly. It's hard to actually gauge public opinion on this. There was actually on the Telegraph website, within the article about Boris in Israel, they had a vote. Click yes or no, was Boris right or was Boris wrong? 56% so far have said yes, which is actually quite reassuring.
It is, but there's also another side to this, which also came up in our press review today. Newspapers have been saying that a large percentage of Jews in this country disapprove of the Israel approach to a two-state solution. Most Jews think that there should be a two-state solution. As you see, the thing I mentioned, that the EU as well has now said that if something is made in the West Bank, it should be said it's made in the West Bank because it's not really Israeli.
I think Boris is actually just standing up against these people who are, in my opinion, inherently anti-Zionist, which is anti-Semitic. When somebody mentioned about he's looking for the Jewish vote, well, he's got mine, because what he was quoted as saying, and I've got to tell you, I love this, and I know he has a way with rhetoric as well, Boris. He said about the boycott of Israel that it was corduroy jacketed, snaggletooth, lefty academics who have no real standing in the matter.
Yes.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Congratulations.
And you know what? I think it's actually very refreshing to hear a politician actually come out, and he's got a history of standing up for Israel, actually coming out and being brave enough to say something. And then what really angers me, though, is that the Palestinian groups that he'd arranged to meet with wouldn't meet with him after that. The Palestinian Authority said that he is now in danger being out there after what he said. I mean, this is, we're trying to get conversation going between Israel and the Palestinians, but they're not coming to the table. They're trying to scare people, like Boris is in Israel. They're scaring him away.
It's horrible. Isn't Mr. Netanyahu also causing trouble for the Palestinians in that he frightens them in exactly the same way that you might say the Israelis are scared by the Palestinians?
It's interesting that a conference in Israel for peace and is very little echoed here. Very interesting things were said that both from the right and the left, and very interestingly also from Uda, who is the leader of the Arab party, a coalition party, and so on. So a lot of talk about the two states, and that's the way forward, reminding us that we are approaching 50 years or since the 67 war. That's a long
50 years since
50
then,
years. So if we look at it like that, nothing has progressed. And he said something very interesting, and we've got to, that, you know, an occupying nation cannot be a free nation. And that's eroded the Israeli society. And coupled with what I've just said is a new move in the Israeli society, a very, very worrying one, the stoning of the rabbi who went to the olive groves. And we've just marked Rabin's anniversary, also calling against leading figures in Israel. Members of the Knesset calling the legal advisor to the Knesset rubbish. You see, all these things are laying down a sediment from something very, very negative in Israel and frightening. If you see all these voices that are coming out now without any direction of Netanyahu or his government for peace, this is a very somber situation, black day.
And you were just saying about Netanyahu not always saying the right thing. And I was talking to my son, Trevor, because he was staying with me this week, and he said, well, he's the best of a bad bunch, but they also because he lives in Israel, they also feel that he is not very diplomatic in some of the things he said, but he's the best of a bad bunch.
Because, you see, one remembers back to the people that have led Israel in the past.
Well, you could almost say the same in England.
Well, they are, but look at Yitzhak Herzog, who is from that ilk. But the scene in the politics have changed. It's a lot of elbows and a lot of spin doctors and a lot of how you present yourself. And those people cannot go along with the new image of the politician. And therefore, they do not stand. And those that stood and withdrew, and there are a lot of them, and significant ones.
Are you thinking of Moshe Dayan?
I think of Moshe Dayan and other ones as well. But the scene in politics have changed. There's so much corruption.
So true. Yeah, and the actual role of a politician, especially the leader of a party, sadly, has so much more to do with image now. Mm. That there are certain leaders who they're not so savvy with the PR side of it. And I hate to say it, but certainly in democratic societies, the PR side of politics is how you win elections now. Mm. And I think Israel, to a degree, have fallen into that trap as well. Netanyahu, he says the right things at the right time. Just before the election, the things he comes out with, he hits the nerve of the nation at that time. He gets the votes. And you're right, it's almost tragic because there are no doubt wonderful leaders in Israel that aren't getting the opportunity because of how politics have changed so much over the years.
So it's a pretty depressing outlook.
I hate to...
Oh, it is. From my family who lives there, it is a depressing outlook. So, and there's very little they can do about it.
Your family don't think that there's going to be much of a change?
They don't at the moment, no.
So would they accept a Boris attitude?
I didn't ask him that.
What do you think they would make of products in the West Bank being labelled and giving the rise to people boycotting them?
They wouldn't agree with it at all, I don't think.
But on the other hand, it's the fact that they are made on the West Bank.
Yes.
And I was going to say, it is, isn't it? They are made there, so why not? I mean, you turn over any kind of plasticware or whatever, it says made in China, made in Taiwan, made it, so why not?
Very
good point.
The other side of the labelling would mean that plants that operate in occupied territories and employ local people, some Arabs as well, and they are a lot employed, will probably lose their positions. And it is very sad because years ago what happened in the Galil. So whoever did that really has to look at all the implications. They might think that it's right, but it will backfire on the population that they really want to protect.
That's the tragic part of it all. Hoover's absolutely right. The tragedy is that the boycotting and the labelling, all it serves is that it affects negatively the Gazans, the Palestinians. That's who actually lose out. Israel's international commerce has improved in the last 18 months, has grown. These boycotts affect the Palestinians, and it's an absolute tragedy because people don't know this. Siravish Lehman, who thinks, oh yes, boycott Israeli goods, they don't know who gets affected by it.
Well, clearly they don't know because it's not made clear to them. But on the other hand, it still is, in a sense, if you look at it from their point of view, it looks at the Palestinians as being treated as, this is untrue as we know, but this is the way they think, of being treated as though they were slaves living in an occupied country, rather like France was occupied by the Nazis for many years, and the French had to work under the Nazis. That's the way they see it. I know it's not true, but you see the point.
I do, but again, this is a problem that we have to face, that we're not doing enough, I don't think.
Well, what could we do?
Well, the information's out there.
When you say we, you mean...
You mean the Jewish...
I think the Jewish community as a whole are far too quiet over these things.
Well, as we've already heard in the news today, the majority of Jewish people in this country believe the Netanyahu way of dealing with things in Israel is the wrong way. And yes. There should be a two-state solution. And this is not the way of creating a two-state solution.
Netanyahu, he's very, as we all know, he's very hardline with his views. He's not a great example of a Jewish leader because people see Netanyahu and they think, that's Israel, and it's not. They think, that's the Jewish opinion, and it's not. I will support Israel to the day I die. Doesn't mean I'm going to support Netanyahu or whoever else is.
But unfortunately, Israel needs a leader like they've had in the past, like Rabin or Barak, people like that, who could save Israel. Because in the end, this is what we all want. We want Israel saved. We want peace in that part of the world. And we're never going to get it, in my opinion, under Netanyahu. And so we've got to find another Barak.
Or Begin.
Or Begin. Yeah. Yes, Begin, surprisingly, yes.
Well, absolutely.
Although he was an extreme right-wing in Israel.
The Prime Ministers by Yehuda Avner, the late, unfortunately, Yehuda Avner, and three-quarters of that book was on Begin, and he did, in a way, create much more peace than we've got now.
Yes, he certainly did. He arranged the peace with Egypt.
Oh, yes.
Which
yes.
is lasted.
Oh, and it nearly yes. was wonderful there. Yes. Yeah. With Nasser, yes.
And the peace with Jordan as
yes.
well.
Yes. Yes. Begin, it's a very interesting example that you brought up because, first of all, we have always to remember who the partner is because it's not only Begin. He had Sadat over
yes,
there.
Yes.
And that's...
That was
crucially
marvelous.
Important,
yes, yes.
And also the position of Egypt within the Arab bloc, and the Arab bloc has changed immensely since then. That's number one. Number two, it was much easier for a right-wing leader, prime minister in Israel, to do such a bold and imaginative step.
But you can't imagine it done
because,
now.
Because he was not... objected to by his own people. Mm. Had at that time a Labour done that, much, much too early, it might not have worked. Well, so everything in its own time is good.
And that's a very good point, actually, because time is up, I'm afraid, Ahuvah. So thank you very much indeed to you and to all of you. But sadly, so we've got to end the discussion, which I'm afraid is going to go on for a very long time yet. But there we are. So Adam and I extend our grateful thanks to our guests, retired audiobook reader Denise Asserson and Ahuvah Cohen from the New End Theatre Beyond. And now it's time for our weekly rabbinic reflection. Today it comes from Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg from New North London Masorti Synagogue.
In next week's beautiful Torah portion, Jacob's most famous dreams in all of literature. Somewhere in the no man's land between fleeing his parents' house and arriving at his uncle's tents, he lays down and he dreams of a ladder connecting heaven and earth. Four times the word hine, behold, is used, more often even than in the story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. First of all, hine sulam, behold, a ladder connecting earth and heaven. And then behold, there are angels climbing it and descending. And then behold, God is upon it. And behold, that very God addresses Jacob personally. There could be no dream more comforting and consoling. Sometimes one can feel that life is pointless, tedious. But to feel and know that earth and heaven are connected, that there is a ladder between, and that there are those who ascend, like, not to me, to my mind, angels, but the people who live with justice, kindness, and courage. And then to think that there is a God upon this ladder, that there is a living, divine, and sacred being within all life, and that that very being speaks to us personally and says, I will protect you wherever you go. There can be no greater dream. Jacob will suffer. He will work first for years that seem like days, and then for years that seem like years, and then for days that seem like years. He will be cheated. His children will better him. He will mourn and he will struggle. But the dream remains, and so it must for us, through all our struggles, that heaven and earth are connected, that it is possible to ascend through the deeds and goodness of which human beings are capable, and that there is a God who can speak to us in our hearts and say, I am with you. There is no greater dream than this.
Thank you to Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg from New North London Masorti Synagogue for this week's Rabbinic Reflection. And that's Sunday Jewish Radio for this week. All that's left for me to do is to thank our guests, Brian Bloom, Ashley Blaker, Denise Asson and Ahuva Cohen, who were on Roundtable, the team, and of course you at home for listening. If you've missed any of this show, then you can hear it when from tomorrow it's available online on Listen Again. Simply go to spectrumradio.net. Remember, you can now hear the most recent editions of Sunday Jewish Radio at any time as a podcast. You can go to sundayjewishradio.co.uk or you can search for us on iTunes. Sunday Jewish Radio is an independent production recorded at the studios of Jewish Care in London and is produced by Adam Bradley and Sue Greenberg. I'm Phil Dave from the whole SJR team. Shavua Tov, and make sure you have yourself a very good week.